From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, The Hunt for Bigfoot, a classic coast-to-coast show in the making. But here's what's happening. Traces of radioactive material from the endangered Japanese nuclear plant are being detected from coast to coast in the United States and Iceland now. But amounts continue, they say, to be far below levels that would cause health problems. They say the development of super-sensitive equipment to detect radiation is both a blessing and a curse, allowing scientists to monitor materials released in these accidents, but also causing unnecessary worry, according to Catherine Higley, director of the Nuclear Engineering and Radiation Health Physics at Oregon State University. In a moment, Tom Blees joins us, author of Prescription for the Planet. We'll talk about all of this. The prospect for ever hearing from the stuck Mars rover Spirit is fading after it failed to respond to repeated calls from Earth. Despite the dismal outlook, NASA will make a last-ditch effort to communicate with Spirit, which fell silent a little over a year ago. If there's still no contact in the next month or so, the space agency will scale back its listening campaign for Spirit and focus on its healthy twin, Opportunity. Nonetheless, it's been a great, successful mission. Robert Zimmerman, space historian, with us. Robert, these things seem to go on forever. They're like the Energizer Bunny, aren't they?
Well, you know, George, this was supposed to be 90 days on the surface for both Spirit and Opportunity each, and it's now been, almost 7 years. For Spirit, 6 years. The spacecraft, it was doubtful they would get back. It's, even now, it's pretty doubtful they'll get a signal back from it. It's the summer solstice has passed already on Mars, and since it can't maneuver because of its stuck wheel, the solar panel probably wasn't getting enough sunlight and to energize the thing. But Opportunity is still going. Opportunity is heading for a very large crater called Endeavour. It's about halfway there, and it's an 11-mile journey. And along the way, the sightseeing is great. If you check on the Opportunity website, it's just wonderful stuff as it passes craters and lunar and rocks and meteorites and stuff like that.
Well, beyond the success of the length of the mission, Robert, has it been successful in terms of giving us information?
Oh, without question. Both Spirit and Opportunity have demonstrated that there was liquid water on the surface of Mars at some time in the past. The geology that they found proves that without doubt. They also has shown that there have been repeated events where there was liquid water, because you've got layering, much like you'd see on Earth, sedimentary layering. So these are spectacular successes without doubt.
Very good. Robert, thank you so much. I always appreciate your feedback here. A Connecticut community is mourning the sudden death of a high school freshman who collapsed while running on a hotel treadmill. Authorities say that Victor Andy Pena died while working out on a treadmill at a Boston hotel. He was in Massachusetts with his family to attend a younger brother's swim meet. The cause of death remains under investigation. Over the last 2 or 3 weeks, a number of high school players have died either playing basketball or, in this particular case, just being on a treadmill. Most of them have had some kind of heart problems that parents just never knew anything about. Well, last week we reported on the death of Coast to Coast guest and world-renowned author, artist, educator, and really the person who brought us the 2012 Mayan calendar date, Jose Arguelles. Jose passed away after a very short-term illness. Over the weekend on Coast to Coast AM, while George was on, George Knapp, a couple of his guests talked about the death of Jose, but unfortunately, they thought it was Jose Escamilla who brought us the story of Rods. Jose, you're very much alive, aren't you?
Absolutely, unless I'm calling from another dimension.
Okay.
I mean, that was surprising.
I'm glad you are, and I guess when they heard the name Jose, they kind of thought it might have been you. And they talked a little bit about it on the air, and some of your family members heard about it. I'm glad you're okay, my friend.
Oh, my God. Yeah, my brother, you know, heard the news on Coast to Coast, you know, Sunday, and he's an avid listener, and he heard that I had died. And I've been working on my film, The Battle of Los Angeles, all night long, so I used to go to bed about 5 or 6 in the morning. And when he called me, you know, about 9 o'clock, you know, I didn't answer. I was fast asleep. And then I finally started waking around 10:30 in the morning. My sister Rose called me, and she said, "Jose, you better call your brother. You better call Manuel, man. He thinks you're dead, man. He's devastated." Blah blah blah. And I go, "What?" You know. So it was it was an innocent mistake, I guess. They just said Jose Escamilla's dead.
Yeah, so just so everybody knows, Jose Arguelles has passed away. He's the one who talked about the Mayan calendar. Jose Escamilla, who's talking with me right now, is very much alive and
Absolutely.
A regular contributor. Okay, Jose.
Absolutely.
All right. You keep ticking, my friend. People get happier as they grow older, according to new research, which claims our best years do not arrive until our late 70s and 80s. See, you have something to look forward to. Traditional wisdom states that the younger years are the best of our lives, with the milestone of 40 meaning that we are over the hill. But in fact, satisfaction and optimism steadily increase after middle age, easily eclipsing the earlier years and peaking as late as the 80s, according to these scientists. An easing of the responsibilities of middle age combined with maturity and the ability to focus on the things we enjoy combined to make old age far more enjoyable than one might expect. This is greatly increased, they say, by having better health, a stable income, and good relationships with family and friends, all according to the scientists. Well, up next, Prescription for the Planet. Tom Blees joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This hour, Tom Blees joins us. Last year, Tom wrote a book called Prescription for the Planet, and he was our very special guest on Coast to Coast. He leads a pretty adventurous life, and in doing so, he and his wife founded a charitable organization to provide safe water suppliers to villagers in Central America. And in the course of fundraising to launch the project, he happened upon some little-known technologies. We're going to talk with him about this entire situation with nuclear energy and just what's going on in this planet. Tom, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very busy, but happy to be back, George.
Well, I'm glad you are, and shed a little light on some of this. First of all, Tom, let me ask you this. Everybody seems to be concerned about radiation. I was at a very special health conference this past weekend. A lot of people were talking about it. The camp was mixed. Some doctors said nothing to worry about yet. Other people are panicking. What's your take on all of that, Tom?
Certainly nothing to worry about in the United States. And even in, you see a lot of scare headlines and that sort of thing. You know, the old, if it bleeds, it leads syndrome. And if your listeners want to just get kind of a very straight up discussion, say updated two or three times a day, if they go to the NEI.org site, it's the Nuclear Energy Institute. There's a big link at the top. It says NEI is following the developments of Japan's nuclear plants. Just click it, and you can update that page two, three times a day, and it just tells you exactly what's happening.
Can we believe them, Tom? And I'm asking you that as an outsider, just wondering. Can we believe this website or these people?
Well, the website itself is very straightforward. The Japanese power company does have a history of a bit of skullduggery, which they got caught at. So, until all is said and done, it's going to be a while before we know exactly what happened. But what is clear is that the situation is definitely being brought under control.
You're working on Go ahead.
Yeah. Today, for instance, there were headlines that they'd found plutonium in the ground there, and, mm-hmm. and it was big scare headlines. But then if you look into it, the amount was so small that they didn't even know if it was from the reactors. It could just be the normal amount that's found all over the world, and they had to actually take the radiological signatures of the plutonium to determine that it was actually from the plant. In other words, even on the plant site, the amount of plutonium was so small that, you know, it was like anywhere in the world. So, excitement and panic sells papers and that sort of thing. But I would say go to the NEI site, just keep an eye on what's happening, and certainly don't be worried about radiation if you're in the United States.
Back in Japan, Tom, there seems to be a lot of confusion in that, you know, several days ago they said you know, you shouldn't drink water if you're in Tokyo. The baby shouldn't. And then the next day they said, no, everything's okay. I guess if I lived there, I'd be very, very puzzled, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but you understand that the permissible levels of these things are extraordinarily low. So when you read it, it's 100 times higher than permissible. That might still mean almost nothing. I think that the Japanese government has been very prudent, and now you see the radiation levels all over diminishing substantially. And again, like the NEI site will keep you up to date on that. But, you know, when all is said and done, I think everybody's going to be moved back in, and it's very doubtful that anybody will die from this. And it was kind of strange to me to watch cable TV in the days after the tsunami, when probably well over 20,000 people died, and 80 to 90% of what was on the news was about a nuclear power plant where, you know, when all is said and done, probably nobody is going to die.
Yeah, they forgot all about the people who were victims of this situation.
Yeah, it was almost a footnote.
You have been working on a form of nuclear power, some kind of system. Tell me about that.
It's called an integral fast reactor, and it was developed at Argonne National Laboratories in the late 80s and 90s. Essentially, it's an extraordinarily safe design that relies not on intervention of pumps and this sort of thing, but strictly on passive safety, so that in the event of a loss of coolant or something like that, the system would automatically shut down. Even if it was running at full power, the heat sink was suddenly shut off. All the operators were dead so that they couldn't put the control rods in. It would simply shut itself down and not even harm the plant. It's so seismically resistant that if you built it right on a fault line and you had the largest conceivable earthquake, it's designed to withstand that far better than, you know, it has far greater seismic resistance to ground acceleration than any plant that's ever been designed. And it burns nuclear waste as fuel, as well as old nuclear weapons and depleted uranium. So we've got enough of this material already out of the ground, so that if we built enough of these plants to power all of the whole planet with all the energy that humanity needs, we've already got enough out of the ground for almost 1,000 years, because it's 150 times more efficient than a normal nuclear reactor.
What are we doing now in terms of inspecting the plants we now have?
Well, I would imagine that they're going to be looking, for starters, at where the backup systems are, especially in the Diablo Canyon and San Onofre plants in California, and make sure that they're not susceptible to tsunamis. It's hard to say what's going to happen. I mean, conceivably, they might just decide that, well, this reactor is just not safe enough, and they might pull the reactor out and put in a new reactor that's designed to withstand earthquakes. Now, when you build a power plant, you've got a whole bunch of parts of the power plant that doesn't have anything to do with nuclear power. The nuclear reactor is basically a heater, and then the heat is transferred through a closed-loop steam system, which is non-radioactive, and that goes into a steam generator and into the turbine. The turbine spins. It runs it through the switchyard. So, and you've got the cooling towers, and all those things have nothing to do with radioactivity, with the reactor itself. You have the same type of thing at a coal-fired power plant. And so conceivably, if they decide that there are reactors in the United States that aren't up to snuff in terms of seismic resistance or whatever, it would be very possible to just remove the reactor and put in a new, much safer reactor, and then the utility companies wouldn't be stuck with all that stranded investment. You'd be able to essentially use probably 80% of the cost would still remain right there, and you just switch reactors.
Was this accident in Japan avoidable, Tom?
Yeah, if they would have put the backup power systems, ironically, if they would have put them up on the second floor where the spent fuel pools were inexplicably located, then they would have had a constant electricity, and most likely nothing would have happened. Now, you know, there's no way that we can tell for sure if maybe some of the pumps or some of the piping or something actually shook loose during the earthquake. You know, we won't know that for a very long time, but certainly the placement of the backup power systems was just ridiculous. And, you know, it's highly unfortunate that it happened, but of course, you know, lessons will be learned from this, and every reactor that's on a coastline is going to be looked at.
Tom, in your work, Prescription for the Planet, you talk about a vision that you believe will dramatically improve the lives of people around this planet while keeping this planet healthy. Let's talk a little bit about that for a moment, if we can. Tell me the premise of all of this.
Well, the idea is that is this. I think pretty much everybody agrees we've got really a lot of people on the planet, and we're supposed to, you know, all demographic projections are that we'll have 3 or 4 billion more by the middle of the century. So,
right.
You know, people say, oh, well, we got to get less people. But, you know, unless you have a plan for somehow without draconian measures killing off a bunch of people, we have to plan for that. And we have to plan for it in such a way that our solutions don't depend on behavior modification, because people will be people. And people who say, oh, you have to be virtuous and, you know, not use as much electricity or whatever, it just doesn't cut it. Just supplying the water alone for 3 billion people on Earth is going to require so much energy and desalination systems just beyond imagination almost. And then there's all the people who are energy poor, billions of people in the world who are way energy poor compared to people in the United States or Europe. And they all want energy. They want to upgrade their lifestyle.
Sure.
So essentially, Prescription for the Planet is laying out a complete comprehensive plan so that every nation on Earth can have energy abundance in the future, cheaply and safely and without harm to the environment. And, of course, then you get to the point where you say, well, if everybody has so much energy and everybody's lifestyle is getting better, then we won't have enough resources. People often say if everybody in the world wanted to live this lifestyle of people in America, that we'd need 3 or 4 Earths because we don't have enough resources. But we actually do. We just don't use them properly. So part of the technology in the book is about plasma converters, which enable us to recycle essentially everything without depending on anybody's behavior. In other words, you don't have to separate your garbage. You just throw everything into the same dumpster and it all gets recycled. So essentially you would be able to have a world full of people that have a very elevated lifestyle and it would be environmentally benign. You could be as foolish as you want. You could leave your house, leave all the lights on, leave the AC on, jump in your Hummer, drive down to Walmart, buy all the plastic garbage that you want, bring it home, throw it in the trash. And from an environmental standpoint, it won't matter a bit. It's silly. It'll cost you some money, but it won't harm the environment or it won't harm your fellow man.
Will the divide between the haves and the have-nots widen in the future?
Oh, boy. That's a horrible thing. Actually, I wrote another book about that, George, but it didn't get published yet. it's a very sad thing what's happening in the United States now. And, you know, I heard you saying that, you know, can the revolution happen here because of that? You know, I think we're kind of in the bread and circus mode of the Romans, you know. People have enough to eat, even if they got to kind of scrape for it. And they got TV at home, which is the circus. And, you know, I don't know. I would like to see more activism, but I'm kind of discouraged about the United States right now.
Is it because of the way things have been headed economically, or maybe we just don't have a plan?
Oh, I think some people have a plan. I think the plutocracy has a plan, and they're executing it very nicely. Let's face it, you know, the harder people work, the less time and energy they have to pay attention to what's really going on. And the easier it is to hoodwink them into voting against their own best interests. And that's what we're seeing happening, you know. Why should the candidate with the most money just be the front runner? It's because he can have more ads, you know. But I guess we're kind of deviating from the point of the show. But
Not really. Not really. Hey, Tom, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back in just a moment. Tom Blees, his work, Prescription for the Planet, his website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll open up the phone lines. Maybe you can share a story about your own community, what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll start our special program on cryptozoology and the search for Sasquatch. Has all the makings of a classic Coast to Coast show. When we come back, we'll take your phone calls and continue our chat with Tom Blees, Prescription for the Planet. That's up next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We've got Tom Blees, Prescription for the Planet. We're going to take your phone calls as well. Tom, what country on this planet seems to be doing it the right way, if any?
Well, now that you ask that, just last week I was at an event at the Russian Embassy in Washington, D.C., and I've been working with the Russians for a couple of years now. They had the Director General of Rosatom, which is their nuclear power industry in Russia, and he basically said that they're following the proposals in Prescription for the Planet. He didn't use the name of my book, but it's essentially, it now seems to be official policy for the nuclear industry in Russia. So I'm still very excited because what we want to do is we want to do an international effort to build the first one of these commercial scale integral fast reactors in Russia with the participation of South Korea, Japan, India, China, the United States, and Russia. And so we're working towards that. I'm absolutely delighted.
Will the capital markets flow to this project?
Well, once one is built, then it's going to be very clear that, that you know, they're designed to be mass-produced and very economical. You know, in the United States and in Germany, anti-nuclear sentiment is so strong, and there's so much confusion and trepidation among the politicians that we'll probably lag. But India is going to be starting up their first commercial-scale fast reactor soon. Russia's already got one. They've had it running for 30 years. China's working on them. South Korea wants to get going on it. So these other countries are going to build them first. I'm just hoping that by doing this cooperative project in Russia, the United States engineers who will be participating in it will bring that information home and say, hey, come on, let's build these things. Because it's really the way to provide energy and an energy abundant future so that we don't end up having, you know, decades of strife while we fight over energy supplies and water supplies.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Jude is in Santa Rosa, California, west of the Rockies. Welcome to the show. Go ahead, Jude.
Hi. Well, you were asking what's right and what's wrong in our community.
Yeah.
And in Pahrump, Nevada, the assessor had been asked to look into whether or not the employees building the new jail had citizenship or work visas because they were all Mexican, Latino, non-English speaking. And she was reprimanded and told that her remarks were blatantly racist and her request was unconstitutional. How can it be unconstitutional?
That's a good question. I have no idea. No idea at all. But, you know, housing is down, Tom. Sales are down. People are having trouble working. It's going to be a tough future, don't you think?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Like we were saying, unless we can turn around this income disparity that we're in the clutches of. I mean, it's worse than it's been since the Gilded Age, just before the Depression. Like a lot of people, I'm looking at other countries to possibly move into if it gets much worse.
Really? You would leave?
Well, it's getting pretty bad, you know. I mean, there's a lot of countries that really have their act together socially compared to the United States, I think.
I'll go down with the ship.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't mean to turn tail and run. I'm doing the best I can to turn things around, but, you know, we'll just have to see. But Yeah, it's discouraging, and you know, maybe what's going on in Wisconsin and some of these other states, maybe the overreach that's happening right now is going to be enough to turn the tide. We'll see.
Bill is in Augusta, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Bill. Thanks.
You're talking about cheap and ubiquitous energy production worldwide and the demands for that. I was wondering what your thoughts were on fuel cell energy production systems like Bloom Energy, which takes a natural gas line and creates electricity out of a box that sits literally right beside your air conditioner in every home, where the production of energy would be outside the home. And companies like FedEx and eBay are already rolling these systems out. I understand that FedEx, 20% of their electrical production is produced on-site there. I was wondering if you what you thought about these technologies.
Well, as I understand it, it utilizes natural gas, right?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, and what we're trying to do is to get away from fossil fuels. So, you know, there are systems that are better than what we have going now, and that may be better, but as long as it's still using natural gas, we're still not cutting down those carbon emissions. So I'm actually working right now on a project that will take CO2 streams from that are now emitted into the atmosphere from natural gas-fired power plants and ethanol plants and coal plants, and we'll make liquid fuel out of it. And so we'll be able to basically get double duty out of carbon. But it will still necessarily be emitted into the atmosphere when you burn the fuel in jet planes or in cars or something like that. It'll mean that we have to drill for a lot less oil and gas, but it's not a final solution. The ultimate solution is to completely get away from fossil fuels. So I see technologies like that as being kind of an interim step where we're trying to get through the transition period until we get to true zero carbon power production.
What is on the cutting edge of technology right now, Tom? This project you've been talking about, the one you're working on, or is there anything else out there?
Well, these are some of the more world-shaking ones. That's why I'm working on them, because essentially these are the ones that promise an energy abundant world where we can also not be overtaxing the natural resources of the planet. There's another one that I'm working on that's a method of isotope separation that would essentially allow us to use uranium 50% more effectively, which would in effect increase the world's uranium supplies by 50% if we start using it. You know, ultimately with these fast reactors, you wouldn't even have to mine uranium anymore. So I think that's certainly the most exciting one. It's the only technology I've seen that promises abundant energy with free fuel for 1,000 years.
Let's go to Wausau, Wisconsin. Karen, first-time caller. Hey, Karen, welcome to the show.
Hi, George. Thanks so much for having me. Hi, John.
Hi.
I love your music, by the way. I was born in 1951, and I remember.
What was I?
I remember when it was a quarter for a gallon of gasoline back in the day. My brother is working on a project with Helo 3, and he said that in a Coke bottle, you'd have enough energy for an entire year to run your house, to run your car, to run anything. And it's actually a byproduct of nuclear power plants. It's a waste product. But he's saying he wouldn't even need to worry about getting that byproduct anymore, because he said something about the moon. I have no idea. He's a genius. I'm not. And so he was talking to a nuclear physicist who said his idea is probably right on. He's probably going to be able to do this. Don't you think that helium-3, being that it wouldn't have any waste, would be a much better alternative than using uranium?
Well, let's see. If it works, possibly. But, you know, there are a lot of technologies that are kind of out there where people say, oh, well, this is probably going to work. And, you know, I look at them and I say, well, I hope it does, you know. But I do know this, and it's already been proven, you know, with decades of operation of these power plants. If you wanted to take a piece of depleted uranium big enough to provide all the energy for your entire life, for all the electricity, transportation, heating and cooling, all the energy that goes into the food manufacturing that you eat and all the things that you use in your life, basically all the energy that you use directly and indirectly, you could get it out of a piece of depleted uranium the size of a half a ping pong ball. And that's proven. So, you know, whether this thing that your brother's working on will work, I don't know. But I can tell you this, a half a ping pong ball ain't much. And depleted uranium is free.
Well, let's go west of the Rockies. We've got 12-year-old Damien in Pendleton, Oregon. Hey, Damien, go ahead. Thank you.
So I wonder if there could be a certain treasury or like...
Hello?
Go ahead, Damien.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
My name is Damien, and I'm from Oregon. And my big question was, I was wondering if they can make a treasury fund that would sort of go to recycling. The reason for that is because, like in Oregon here, we recycle so much that they wanted to raise rates. I was figuring, why can't they wanted to raise taxes, and why couldn't they just make a big fund that goes all the way to that so that they don't have to worry about specific places getting higher tax rates from the other, and that it would make a lot of things easier. And people would be able to make money, like little kids could donate to that, and kids are our future, so we could teach them around that, and we could have them recycle, and soon it just goes as a normal thing, instead of it's like something that people do just for the heck of it.
Interesting comment, Damien. What do you think about a federal fund for recycling there, Tom?
Well, we won't need it if we build plasma converters, because you'll just be able to throw everything into the same dumpster and everything will be recycled. So you won't have to have a completely separate infrastructure for recycling. You won't have the recycling trucks coming by every week. You'll just have a garbage thing. And you'll put everything from poopy diapers to old tires and drain oil and asbestos and nerve gas. I mean, everything will go into the same thing, and it'll all get recycled. So so we won't really need any special effort. And a couple of these have been running in Japan for quite a while, and we're now starting to build some in other parts of the world. So this is a cutting-edge technology that ultimately, it's going to. We'll use it for all our garbage. We won't need landfills anymore. We get a byproduct of building materials, which we'll be able to get very cheaply. And you get basically the elements of hydrocarbons. So we'll be able to make anything that we now make out of petroleum, out of our garbage.
What about Tesla technology? Will we ever be able to pull energy straight out of the atmosphere?
I can't say that we can. So, like I say, I'm concerned about climate change, and in order to try to alleviate that problem as much as humanly possible, we have to do it fast. And so, while I find it fascinating to look at all the research that's being done in a lot of other areas, my idea basically is, let's take technologies that we already have that we know are going to work and start deploying them ASAP, and then if something else comes along that's better, hey, I'm all for it. But we already know. We already have the technologies in hand that we need. So, hopefully someday that'll happen. But in the meantime, let's use what we have.
Let's go to Halifax, Pennsylvania. Wayne's with us east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Wayne, take it away.
Okay, how you doing? Our governor... Tom Corbett, he just announced the other day that all the rainfall we had, there was a high level of radiation coming from China. And he says when the water dissipated through the ground, the levels went down a little bit. I thought the radiation stays where it stays, you know. I don't know. Is it true? Is it possible?
What is the life of radiation in time, and does it dissipate over time?
Well, it dissipates. It has what's called a half-life. So say you have a certain amount of, say, cesium-137, which is a radioactive material, and it's got a half-life of about 30 years. That means that in 30 years, you'll have half as much. And in 30 more years, you'll have half as much again. So, you know, if you go through 10 half-lives, which for cesium-137 would be 300 years, by then you're down to a point where you have almost nothing. So it depends on what the radioactive material is. Some have very long half-lives, like plutonium-239, which is a what we call weapons-grade plutonium, which they make, you know, nuclear bombs out of. That has a really long half-life, and that means that it's not immediately dangerous. You can hold it in your hand. But something like cesium-137 that's got a 30-year half-life, that's highly radioactive. It's got a shorter half-life. So the shorter the half-life, the more dangerous it is from an immediate standpoint.
The atomic bombs that hit in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I don't think then had long lives, did they? Because they were rebuilding those cities almost immediately.
Well, most of the radioactivity ended up in the fallout, and it blew out to sea, most likely, yeah. They were able to rebuild them. And as a matter of fact, Bikini Atoll, where they did the H-bomb tests, is now a very highly regarded dive mecca because nobody's been out there for so many years, and the coral reefs are just absolutely beautiful. So people are going out there for vacation now.
Do you think the radioactivity from World War II ended up on the west coast of the United States at all?
Well, those two bombs were just a drop in the bucket compared to all the atmospheric tests that the U.S. and Russia and France and I think England also did. In the early years of the Cold War, I mean, there were a couple thousand tests, and there was a lot of bombs blown off and a lot of radiation moving around.
And say, Tom, who's to say that people who have come down with leukemia and other forms of cancer might not have contracted this disease from the radiation from some of these tests? Who knows?
Well, actually, that's very very possible indeed. But I think what we find in most cases where you look at kind of low-dose radiation is that lifestyle makes a much bigger difference in terms of your propensity for coming down with cancer. People's dietary and smoking habits and this sort of thing. They've done tests with people, for instance, who've worked in industrial locations where they were exposed to radioactivity, and they found that they have less cancer than most people do. But, you know, part of the reason is that they're paid well, and so they eat better, and usually they're not smokers and, you know, that type of thing. So I think that being overly concerned about minuscule amounts of radiation, which, you know, we're exposed to radiation all the time from a number of sources, I think being overly concerned with that, I think you kind of have to look at, well, what else am I doing to my body and to my general health? And, take care of that as best you can. There's we have a website called at thesciencecouncil.com. And you have to make sure to put the in the beginning. But if you go to thesciencecouncil.com, there's a little chart with little boxes on it that describes radiation levels and this sort of thing.
All right, super. Thanks, Tom. Tom Blees, Prescription for the Planet. I'll be back with our exposé about Bigfoot on Coast to Coast AM.